We have a great subscription offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our digital edition for 12 months for just $24.99. That's 6 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your inbox for less than $4.20 an issue. Only $24.99 for a full year. So don't wait. To subscribe, go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
My guest today on Talking Australia is Sophie Mattison. Right now, Sophie is about halfway through an epic trek from the west to the east coast of Australia, and she's doing it all on foot, accompanied only by her brace of camels. It's an extraordinary adventure, but it all began just as the rest of us were closing down as COVID was starting to change our lives. Sophie found herself setting off on this incredible journey. Today, I'm talking to Sophie as she is about to set off on the second part of this adventure. Hello, Sophie.
Hi, Chrissy.
So tell us where you are right at the moment. Describe it for us.
Yeah, so I'm on Beltana Station in the Northern Flinders Ranges, which is a lovely old historic station, actually. And it's kind of the birthplace of camels in Australia almost. So I think it was about the third importation of camels arrived at Beltana Station, and it was actually set up as a breeding ground for camels out here. So it's quite significant, I guess, in the camel world, and kind of quite an honour to be here with my camels, really.
And tell us about, take us right back to how did somebody like yourself end up doing this trek across Australia with camels? It's not something that we all think of doing. And obviously we tend to think of Robin Davidson's tracks because it's a very well-known story, but also we had the movie that came out a couple of years ago. So I guess when people think about walking across Australia with camels, they think of that. But it's a very different expedition that you've undertaken. You're actually planning to cross the entire continent from east to west. So just take us back to, you know, where the idea came from, what it is about camels. Did you have any experience of camels before you started, and why they would make such great companions on a trip like that?
Well, it was about 4 years ago now that I got into camels, and I was actually working in a lot of film and TV before that. I was just only at the beginning going to take a short break and do sort of something different for 6 months. And I stumbled across people milking camels. And I thought, oh, what a great job. Like, it's so strange, so bizarre. But why not, you know, do something outdoors? And I always said I had a bit of a passion for farming. So I got into that and started, I guess, this love affair with the camel. I just realized what amazing animals they are, incredibly intelligent, and how many different uses there are for them, I guess, throughout Australia. So, you know, people milk camels. There's camels that are can be used for trekking. So I just found them really fascinating animals. So I guess for me, my trip kind of evolved from that love of the camel. It was sort of then that I wanted to learn everything I could about them. So I went from the dairy to the Flinders Ranges, actually where I am now, and I started learning about camels with a company here, Camel Treks Australia, learning about how to walk with camels through the bush and how to camp out with them. And then I headed on up to Uluru and I learned more about camels up there, and so it was then that I started, I found this passion for walking in the bush with camels, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to do a trek of my own? I'm not even quite sure how the idea came to walk across Australia, but it's sort of, you know, one of those things where at some point you sort of think, oh, wouldn't it be cool to do something? And then that seed has been planted. And then from then on it was, it became this goal. And also, I guess, a way to sort of to challenge myself personally. But really, probably the main passion for me was to get camels of my own from the wild and to train them for this trek. That was really my goal.
And how would you, I mean, with something like that, if you're going to take a camel from the wild, you've been out there, you obviously know your way around the Flinders and you've been around Uluru. I mean, most of us don't really go to these kind of places. Are there just wild camels running around in herds, or, you know, take us through the process of how you would go about acquiring camels for something like
that. Yeah. So I guess that was one of the things that fascinated me when I discovered this love of camels, is that we have this huge population of wild camels in Australia. And they're not native to Australia, but they were brought over in the late 1800s. And they were used for basically exploration of the outback. And they were used to cart huge wool bales out for export during the wool boom days, and then also, you know, to supply all of the stations out here with any equipment they needed. So the camel trains would move through areas that vehicles were not able to. And then when cars and trucks started to come in, the camels became obsolete. So their owners, rather than see them shot, which was what the government at the time proposed to do, they actually released them into the wild. And from there, you know, we had no clue, but camels just absolutely thrive in Australia. So these camels that were released, they just bred up, and now we have actually the only population of wild one hump camels in the world. Well, I guess technically they're not wild, but you know, there are feral population that has gone, you know, that is running wild. So. So, yeah, that interested me. You know, I thought, whoa, it's this huge resource that we have out there in Australia. Yeah. And, so for me, I was at the time, I was at Uluru, and the company I was working for there, Uluru Camel Tours, they took most of their trekking camels from the wild. And so I went out to a station called Mulga Park Station, which is just on the NT South Australian border. And I went out there with my boss at the time, and we went wild camel mustering, and we brought in about 90 camels from the Western Desert region.
Goodness.
So these camels, I mean, although we collected them from a station, they are coming in basically from the wilds of the deserts out
and
there.
How do you muster camels? Is it the same as mustering cattle? Is it with a truck or a helicopter or dogs, or how does that work?
Yes, kind of similar. So mainly it's with vehicles, those little buggies that you see with the crazy suspension that rip through the bush. So they're little sort of 4x4s, I guess. And so we went out with those in vehicles and motorbikes, and you basically sort of spot the camels, and then you start to usher them towards a set of yards, and then as you get closer to the yards, you have to jump off the dirt bikes, because you start to be in a bit of a vulnerable position on those, and jump in the cars, and you push the camels into those yards. But it's it's quite a adrenaline pumping, really. Sounds like
the Wild West.
Yeah.
And tell me, are they the camels that you would take from the wild? Would these still be always be female camels? Is that who's in the herd?
No. So we actually, the day that I went mustering for my lot, we came across multiple different herds, and so the makeup's a little bit different with each of them. So we came across a couple of mobs that was a dominant bull, and then all his females, including some youngsters in there as well. We also came across what I like to call a bachelor herd, which will be young male camels that have sort of got to the age where they're in sexual maturity, and they've been kicked out of the herd by that dominant bull. And then they roam around as solitary bulls, but often those younger bulls, they'll find one another, and they'll sort of develop this little bachelor pad. So a couple of boys out on the town looking for trouble. So I think we brought in a little mob of about 9 of those, and we sort of started to join them up in the buggies, and then we had a big a big herd that we were pushing into the yards.
And do you dry them then? Once you've rounded them up in the outback area like that into those yards, how do you move them then?
Yeah, so what we always like to do is leave them a day or two as well to settle down in the yards there. I mean, the properties out here are so huge that they've been running for several kilometres. So you know, there's a lot of lactic acid build up in them, and they've had, a slightly stressful experience probably. So we let them sort of relax in the yards and have some hay there. And then they got on board a truck. And the five that I had chosen, they came to Uluru, and so I trucked them to Uluru, and it was from there that I started training them.
And how did you select them? What were you looking for?
Well, actually, I got a bit of help from my boss at the time, because to me, I looked out on those 90 camels and I was just like, oh, they're all beautiful. I'd take all of them. but he really knew what he was doing. So I relied on that knowledge of more experienced camel people than myself. And I guess probably the main thing that he was looking for was confirmation. So you want a camel that's sort of a nice shape, a nice size. And also the other biggest thing is age. So I've got four boys and one girl. My boys are kind of late teens, I guess. So it's not a bad age to get them, because they're almost fully grown. They've maybe got a couple of years more of growing to do. But also, you've got a long working life left in them. And they're fit and healthy at that age.
How long do they live, Sophie? What's their lifespan usually?
Well, they can actually live up to, there's reports of camels living up to 50 years old. So it's a long, long lifespan for them. So actually mine, when I got them, they were probably around the 6-7 year old mark. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty scary to think that I'll have these camels probably for most of my life, really. Mm. Yeah.
And so you've got your camels, and then you had to name them. So tell us what you named them and
yes.
How you came up with your names.
So I've got Jude, Delilah, Charlie, Clayton, and Mac. And I always wanted camels that I could sing to. So a couple of them are song names. So Jude and Delilah are song names, so I can belt out a tune to them when I'm on the road. And Clayton comes from Clayton Station, which is up the Birdsville track, and that's actually one of the first places I learned to trek with camels. So I named him after that. Macaulay is named after, or Mac is named after, Macaulay's Lane, which is where my dad's property is in Queensland. Charlie is named after a little camel. He's actually one of the first camels that I ever met at Kew Camel Dairy on the Sunshine Coast. And I just absolutely fell in love with that little camel. So I named my Charlie after that Charlie.
And did you straight away, I mean, were you able to tell the difference? It seems like a daft question, because you must know them so well right now that you spend all this time with them. But, I mean, they would probably all look the same to me. But so did you immediately know the difference, tell the difference between all of them?
Yes, I think it's something that I've got better at as the years have gone by. I remember when I first started working with camels and just seeing a big herd of 80 camels and being like, oh my goodness, they all look exactly the same. How do you tell them apart? And it's just kind of like the longer you work with them, I guess like any animal, you just start to see the sort of subtle differences. So, they all have different, to me now I look at them and they look totally different.
Nice.
They have different shaped faces, they have different shaped humps, different colorings. All of mine are sort of, I guess, slightly a different color. Their coat is a little bit different. Some have straight hair, some have curly hair. And
just
I guess
like
that
us
comes,
humans, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess probably in Australia we have, it would almost be like having thoroughbred horses compared to Arabian horses but it's just that no research has ever really been done on the camels that we have in Australia. Mm. In places like India, they have, registered camel breeds, but here we kind of, we might even have our own blue healer. So we just don't know.
Right. Okay. That's interesting, isn't it? We just don't really think about there being different species. We just think whether they've got one or two humps. That's as far as it goes. Very scientific, really. So if you tell me, when it comes to training the camels, what is it that you're training them to do? And what's the, how do you achieve that with a group of what are really wild animals?
Yeah, so I probably gave myself about a year that I was, just over a year that I was training my five. And I guess one of the first things is starting to develop a bit of trust between you and the animals. You know, even though they're such large animals, camels, they're big scaredy cats, really. They're still a prey animal, and so for them you're this scary predator. So it took a long time for mine to really sort of accept that I was, a leader in the herd, or one of them rather than someone that's out to get them. So I actually spent, probably about almost the first month or maybe more just actually picking yummy camel food and wheeling wheelbarrows of yummy camel food into their yards and just trying to get them to like me, really.
Yeah, so food's always very important in the training, I suppose.
Food is always, yeah.
Yeah, just like with
your pet dog, to a certain extent. Yeah, but then sort of, I guess after that, I like to not use treats too much, really, because they can become a bit like the treats are the only thing, and the brain switches off. They can become a bit treat obsessed. So after that, you can kind of use you can play some sort of psychological games with them, I guess. When you're tying, it's a lot of repetition. So after that point, I put halters on my camels and I would tie them to a rail, and it was just getting them used to I guess being, having something on their face and being restrained. And and they're just so amazingly smart camels. At first they might fight that pressure of the rope, but they give in very easily, and they learn very easily that it's not the end of the world. Mm. And then you teach a camel to hoosh. That means to sit down, basically, because camels are so tall, you have to load all of the equipment and put a saddle on them from a seated position, otherwise that I just can't reach. So you can do that by putting a rope around their front leg and then up and over the hump, and you kind of leverage that front leg so that it drops to the ground. And all the time you say the word hoosh. And they can learn that. That's really actually, it seems like a big ordeal, but it's actually really only probably half a morning's work. They pick it up so incredibly fast. And once they've learned that word, you can pop them out into a paddock for years and they will still remember that word. They have incredible memories. And all the time I reward my camels by actually almost sort of doing the opposite to what people think. Everyone wants to get in there and love them and cuddle them and everything, but like I said, you're still a predator to them. So for me, I kind of reward them by actually going, okay, you've done what I've asked you to do. Now I'm going to get out of your personal space. Because for them, it's it's still incredibly intimidating.
It's like pressure on them when there's someone around them. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. So I go, the reward is, okay, you've done what I want. Now you get your space and you can chill out without me being around. And you often find when you sort of stand back and you sort of give them their space, they then want to come into your space more rather than you sort of trying to push all this love and affection onto them too soon.
What an interesting insight into kind of how their minds work. And tell me about, so did their personality start to come through quite quickly?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And that's another thing with training is you, when you start to sort of see their personalities, you can kind of train them according to their personalities. So something that might work for one camel just really doesn't work for another camel, and vice versa. And I had a little camel, Clayton, talking about that affection side, and he would just, scream every time I went near him. So camels do this crazy roar, and what they do when they're really terrified is they actually will throw their cud up onto you. So like the contents of their stomach, that's where camels get the reputation for spitting. It's actually right. Not saliva, it's cud. And Clayton was just so terrified from the beginning that, you know, you only had to go sort of 3 meters away from him and he would just be an absolute, you know, screaming like a wild monster. And and now he's starting to turn into a really sweet camel, but I just learnt with him very quickly to stand back. And he's a very hard worker, but he's probably never going to be a real cuddly camel. He likes to do the job. He likes to know what's expected of him, but he doesn't want to be your friend unless he sort of comes into your space. Whereas I have another camel, Charlie, who is just loves to be patted, loves kids, loves laying his head in your lap. You know, so yeah, they're all very, very different.
We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $39.99 and save 10% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $39.99. You'll find our special subscription offer at australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
So there you are, and you've been training them for probably, was it about a year, did you say you were training?
Yes,
yeah. And then you've got the so you've got the camels, but you've also got the logistics of this traverse of the Australian continent. You're going to be walking through all kinds of different terrains, also different kinds of properties, some private property, some public property, maybe sometimes along the road. Tell us about the planning of such a long remote area walk.
Planning was huge. It was really like a year's worth of camel training and a year's worth of planning as well. So I get also accumulating all the equipment, that was massive. So all of my saddlery had to be made or acquired. You know, there's so many bits and pieces of safety equipment that you need, and camping equipment that you need, and then after that, I guess I started to look at the maps and think about which route I wanted to go. And probably the biggest thing when I sort of came to that point that stood out for me was there was this huge road that went west to east, and it was called the Anne Bedell Highway, and it traversed the Great Victoria Desert. And I thought, well, that seems like a very obvious choice of roads to take. So I based a lot of my trip around sort of that road. Which when I say it's called a highway, which is it's kind of ironic. It's a very rough desert track, really.
Yes, this is of course it's Anne Bedell because it's named after Len Bedell's wife. Len Bedell being the surveyor that went out with his grading vehicles and graded a lot of these desert tracks way back in the 1960s. Len's an Australian legend. Highway does seem like a little bit of a stretch.
Yes. it's incredible, the roads that Len built back then. So I sort of got my route planned out, and then I started contacted every single station along the road just to let them know I was coming, and station owners were incredibly helpful in that way, that you know, they could tell me information about what was the best track to take, and you know, where there was good feed, what water points were turned on, and so it was definitely helpful having that local knowledge. And permits as well to go across Aboriginal land, and working, you know, distances between water points, and you know, if I was going to need any help with delivering water. So there was a lot of logistics there.
Yeah, and so you found yourself finally ready to start, just as well, coming off the back of a catastrophic bushfire season in Australia.
Yes.
and then turning into a global pandemic. So were there moments where you thought that you might not be able to go ahead?
Yeah, I was very lucky timing wise, actually, because I arrived with the camels. I tracked the camels from Uluru across to the coast of WA about a week before all of the borders started closing for the pandemic. So if I had been any later, I wouldn't have even been able to begin my trip. I wouldn't have even made it into WA. So that in some ways the timing couldn't be more perfect. And then, you know, luckily I was starting from one of the biggest state in Australia, so it was going to be months before I was crossing any more borders. So, you know, I remember at the time it was very uncertain what was going on, and a lot of permits were revoked. And I wasn't going through any Aboriginal land to begin with, and I thought I was just going through station country, and I thought I'll just start and I'll just hope that, you know, hope that things evolve or things improve as I go. And it actually ended up working very, very much in our favour, because we just barely saw any people on the road. We had the roads all to ourselves, which was great.
So COVID-19 came in as of from nowhere, something that really changed everybody's lives. But it didn't stop you going ahead with the expedition. And in fact, it wasn't all bad news for your expedition. So tell us about how that affected your plans.
I tracked the camels from Uluru to Western Australia about a week before all of the borders basically started shutting. So it was very lucky timing. If it had been a week later, I wouldn't have even been able to start the trip. So very lucky. And then it was sort of a bit uncertain as to how it was going to go. But in the end, it actually ended up working out really in our advantage, because especially along the Amberdell Highway, no one else was actually able to get permits except myself. So because of the way that we were traveling, and we were going to be coming into Aboriginal land at such a slow pace, we basically would have been doing our own form of social distancing. So they were happy for me to still come through. And I remember at first I was really nervous about hitting that remote track, knowing that there'd be no one out there. And in the end, that was actually the most special experience, because even though deserts, you know, are remote in Australia, there's still a huge number of people that do explore the interior of Australia. And, you know, in any normal year, I would have had, you know, a couple of cars every second day, third day or so maybe coming past. But this year there was no one. No one had travelled that road from March, and I was coming through in September. So I really got to have that special solitude in the desert, which was amazing.
Yeah. So I mean, it wasn't all bad. I guess that that might have also been a disadvantage in some ways, because I guess that you would have known that there were going to be people coming through fairly regularly if anything went wrong for you. And so I guess in some ways that also must have changed your planning a little bit, knowing that there probably wasn't going to be anyone who was going to be able to bail you out or bring you water or, you know, take a message somewhere for you.
Yes.
So how did you deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because I always thought, oh, you know, if I really get into trouble, if I'm, you know, if I've forgotten something, or, you know, if I'm running really low on water, there's always, you know, people willing to help you in the outback, and there's always people driving past, you know, with four-wheel drives that are kitted up to the roof, and they always have excess stuff. So it did make me nervous at first. But I had a huge amount of help from the Indigenous community out there, Oak Valley, which is just on the South Australian side of that track. And they were amazing, because I looked at those water points, and once there's water tanks across most of the Western Australia section, and they've been put out on the road just so that, you know, if anyone has an emergency, there is water there. But on the South Australian side, there's really no infrastructure. So I started to look at those distances and go, oh my gosh, I'm actually really going to need help out here. And
I had contacted Oak Valley anyway to get permission to walk across, and that's when they then put me onto their ranger team, and the ranger team said, yeah, no worries, we're going to, you know, we're happy to come out and do a water drop for you and your camels, and we'd love to bring the whole community out too. So it sort of started this relationship with me and Oak Valley that was, yeah, one of the highlights of the trip really so far. They, every time I sort of, you know, had moments where I was feeling down or feeling lonely or remote out in the desert, they would pop by, and rather than just do the one water drop, they actually ended up doing four water drops for me, and also then contacting the Cooper Pedy Rangers as well on the other side and getting them to help me out too. So they were such a help. And they were just able to come and camp out with me and, you know, share a little bit about Anangu culture and speak Wonderful. Language. And it was just very, very special.
And did you have like a satellite phone, or how did you stay in touch, or was it just all planned in advance?
Yeah, most of it was planned in advance, but the satellite phone is great, actually. The satellite, I normally always call people in advance and sort of give them a rough idea of when I'm coming through, and then I'll sort of do a follow-up call with the satellite phone when I, you know exactly what day I'll be traveling by. And it's also been just so good to be able to keep connected with friends and family, you know, just even to send a text to say that I'm okay. And, you know, it's sometimes it's kind of, in some ways, like I always think it's a little bit of a blessing and a curse. Like anything, you can kind of almost develop a bit of an addiction for it, you know, as if, like, we're addicted to social media and screens, you know, when we're back in reception. Even when you're out of reception, I found like you can almost become a bit addicted to the sat phone, you know, and I found myself constantly sort of turning it on to sort of be like, is there anyone, you know, is anyone
message
me? Is
anyone
me?
Calling me?
And
have they forgotten about me? Very understandable.
That's right. You can kind of, you know, lean on it as a bit of a crutch, really. I have this one memory of standing up on a sand dune, and it was before I'd actually connected with Oak Valley, and I was almost right in sort of the South Australia side of Western Australia, right in the center of the desert there. And I remember just feeling so incredibly isolated and remote. And I think I'd called home to sort of have a chat with someone back home, and then I hung up, and I remember just like clinging onto the sat phone with the aerial up, just not knowing that I had to turn it off to preserve battery, but not wanting to turn it off because I felt that would, you know, all of a sudden disconnect me with that outside world. And it was really just felt incredibly scary and heartbreaking to switch
well,
off
I guess
from everyone.
Really, a big part of what you, must have been in your mind when you were sort of planning it, is that you knew that you were going to be doing this on your own, only in terms of not being in human company. You were obviously going to have your animals, and the important thing to point out is you don't ride the camels, do you, Sophie? They are just purely pack animals to carry your gear and
yes.
for you to sort of be with for your company.
Absolutely. So I mean, I do have a riding saddle on my lead camel, Jude. So I guess I wanted to have the option out there if, you know, if I was to injure myself or something like that, that I could get on and ride. But to be honest, for me, like I enjoy walking. You don't want to be in the saddle for sort of 6 hours. It's, you know, you end up getting sore that way. So, and then it becomes a bit of an ordeal, you know, sitting them up and down to get on and off, and you know, you've got to sort of rearrange pack gear and stuff. But I actually just find the whole thing easier walking, and I'm quite happy on the ground, and it's a little bit of a safety thing too. You know, you have a lot more control on the ground, especially in those desert stretches. You know, where I had wild camel encounters. The last thing you want to be doing is having to get out a rifle in a hurry from, you know, from a seated position on top of a camel, you know, just too slow.
So it's for me, the idea is that you're walking you're walking with camels. You're not crossing Australia on camels. You're crossing Australia with camels, which is quite
walking with camels. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've set off. I mean, you start off at beautiful Shark Bay on the west coast of WA, and your camels probably saw the ocean for the first time. How do they respond?
I remember actually we arrived on the truck. We sort of hit Geraldton, and it was just this so happy to all of a sudden see the ocean, and their little heads were popping out of the truck, sort of looking around a bit wide-eyed, and then we headed on up the coast to Shark Bay. And then there was the first day that I actually walked them out onto the beach, and the funny thing was, is I thought, oh my gosh, they're gonna think, what the hell is this huge, you know, blue expanse? And instead, all that they were worried about was spooking at a little tiny shed that was on the beach. They thought that was way more scary than the huge expanse of ocean, which was kind of funny. But no, but I remember actually I took Jude right down, and you know, the rest of the camels behind him. I took him right down to the waterfront. And bless him, he got right in there and he pawed around at the water, and then he, you know, tried to drink a little bit of it, and then of course realized how salty it was and flicked his head around and spat salt water everywhere. And so that was his first experience of the ocean.
We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $39.99 and save 10% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $39.99. You'll find our special subscription offer at australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
So then you started walking, as we've talked about, you're following the Anbidell Highway, this outback trek. What kind of pace were you making? I mean, how far would you get in any given day?
I would probably we did build it up. So at the beginning, when we first set off from Shark Bay, we were actually only doing 10K days. And that's just because it was new for us all. It was new for the camels. It was new for me. You know, they were still sort of getting used to the routine of things. And then we sort of slowly stepped it up to 15K. And then probably by the end, we were doing on average 18 to 20K a day. Which seems like nothing really compared to, you know, if you're bike riding or walking or anything, you can actually, you know, smash out quite a few more Ks. But for me, a lot of the day revolves around camel care. So they have to eat. I have to feed my animals during the day too. So, and because they're big animals, you know, they require a certain number of hours grazing. So I try and graze them for about 4 hours. So 4 hours of daylight is spent with them eating. So that sort of really restricts the amount of time that you can actually be on the road walking with them. And we're also not the fastest of vehicles. We only walk at about 3-4K an hour sometimes. So it's quite an amble.
Yes. And so everything probably on something like this does revolve around the availability of feed for the camels. So how had you sort of planned in advance for that? And what were the challenges that you faced, especially coming into those arid desert zones where, you know, you don't really see an awful lot of vegetation on the ground?
Yeah, it was, I would actually say probably the hardest part of the trip for me was feeding the camels. I mean, camels, they can eat a huge variety of stuff out there, and Western Australia, actually, you know, they're best when they're in those arid regions, and there's a lot of food that they can eat. But the problems we faced was that most of Western Australia was in the grip of a pretty bad drought. It was very, very dry. So there was a lot of the station country we passed through as well. You know, even people had cattle that were struggling too. And so it was just feeding them off very little and incredibly dry stuff. So not the best. And I started to really see their weight deteriorate. And then when we got out into the desert, In some ways, you have a bit of an advantage because then you're moving off stock country, and so when you're heading out into the desert, the only other thing that's out there, large animal wise, is camels. So there was almost more feed in some of the desert stretches. But then the next problem we faced is that there'd been a huge wildfire in the western half of the Great Victoria Desert. So there was patches that where there was actually a little bit of new growth coming through that the camels were loving, but then patches that were very desolate. I mean, we're talking sort of fairly bare sand dunes as far as the eye can see, and which is unusual for Australian deserts, especially the Great Victoria Desert, because we have a lot of vegetation in our deserts in Australia, and that's why our camels thrive out there. But there was really some spots, and definitely some spots in the desert where I'd seen wild camel tracks, and I noticed they were actually, it was almost like they were using the Amberdale Highway as a camel highway. They had sort of gone, nope, there's no feed here. We're just going to carry on walking up the road and just keep walking until we find better feed. So I really struggled with my camels in a shocking season, really. And not only that was an issue, but because the feed was so dry out there, they weren't getting a lot of moisture from their feed. So they camels can absorb so much moisture from what they're eating. And so I was relying on that for them to be able to go fairly long distances without water. But they got thirsty. They got very, very thirsty because they weren't getting that water. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started to really panic that I had underestimated actually how long that they could go for, and the pace of the walk slowed right down because they were hot and tired, and all they wanted to do, we'd pull up at camp and all they'd wanted to do is sit around in the shade. At this point of time, it had sort of reached September out in the desert, and all of a sudden got very hot too, and the camels still had their winter coat on. And they were really struggling, and we were hunkering down in the shade for the portion of time where they should have been out grazing. So then they were losing weight, because of that as well.
And you were coming into the hotter part of the year anyway by then, weren't you?
We were. And it's like it changes overnight. It literally went from winter to summer in a day. And then, we started to get horrendous dust storms and hot, hot, dry winds. And it was actually luckily around about that time, which was when I started, when Oak Valley community popped by, and so they were such, they came to my rescue with all the water drops at that point.
So I guess you were feeding them from drums of water that were being brought in, is that right?
Yes, we did struggle with water actually not far into the beginning of the trip, because there's quite a lot of stations on the coast of WA that were previous sheep stations, and then they've either been abandoned or they've been created as nature reserves. And so on the maps that I was looking at, there were so many bore points, and I thought, great, there's tons of places to water my camels. But no, they're all old sheep watering points, and from back in the days when they ran sheep there, and now they don't any longer. So most of those bore points were actually shut down. So we had to get a delivery of water about a month in, which my friend Greg, who had helped me drive the camels over in the truck, he came out with a big water tanker and delivered some water out for me and the camels. But I never ever relied on natural water. It's just too hard. And you'll get yourself into trouble.
Does that mean that you have to carry water actually on the camels, that you're carrying your own water a lot of the time?
Yes, I do. Yeah. So I carry water for me and also for the camels. So I'll sort of water them at one cattle trough. And then I might walk for 2 weeks, and I'll maybe give them a drink a week in from the jerry cans that they're traveling along with them on their backs.
There's a lot to consider, and your camel and the welfare of your camels is obviously paramount on something like this.
Yeah. I remember doing definitely kilometers walking, just constantly doing water calculations in my head, trying to think, you know, okay, we're carrying this amount of, you know, we're carrying 100 litres of water now, and, you know, if I give Macaulay 20 litres and Charlie this many litres, and then how many litres will I have that, you know, at the end of that, and then how many more Ks do we have to walk? It sort of almost became a bit of an obsession. But, yeah, you just can't help it. It's so important out there.
It sounds like, at least, however, by doing that, you're living in the moment then. You're living every day reacting to things that are happening around you and what you're doing, rather than sitting there worrying about other things maybe that we all do when we're not out doing epic treks like this. So tell us about how it did feel. Tell us something about the feel of what it's like to be out in those desert areas, just yourself, the silence, or was it silent? You know, tell us, most of us never really get to experience remoteness in that way, a long way from anybody and anything. And tell us some of the wonderful things about that.
Yeah, it's very special. It's very special watching the landscape change. I think as well, you really get to see the subtle differences in landscape. I think a lot of people kind of can, you know, they think, oh, there's nothing out there in the outback. You know, it's just a whole lot of nothingness, and it's so not true. It's there's a lot to see out there, and because you are, you know, you're looking at what they're eating. You're thinking about, you know, water points too. You might spend an entire day. Yeah, looking at the little footprints in the sand of other animals that have been through here. So I think the really special thing for me too is you start to feel connected with the landscape that you're walking through. You're not whizzing by in a car, you know, in a little bubble basically, with, you know, shielded from the elements. You become a part of it. You know exactly what the moon is doing, you know when it's rising, you know how full it is, because it all is valuable information for what you're doing in terms of how much light you'll have that evening. You're looking very much at the plants and how the plants are changing and what that means in terms of, you know, maybe how high elevation you are, or whether you're down sort of at salt lake level. You're looking at the other animals that are around and which way the birds are traveling, and wondering, you know, where they're drinking from and what water might be out there. And to feel, it's a very special feeling having that connection with the landscape, and also just knowing I think, you know, the world is just so populated these days too. So we're very lucky in Australia to be able to go places and to still be able to have these feelings. And I think that was one of the biggest things that appealed to me, was to be able to see some of these parts of the country that not many other people have seen before, and to be able to have that special sense of feeling like nature is king and or king or queen, and you know, and we're just a speck moving through the environment.
Yeah. And so tell us, did you meet people? Did you call into stations? Did you, you know, how many people did you meet, and what were they all doing out there in the desert themselves?
Yeah, well, I loved that too. I met some amazing people on the way. Station owners were absolutely fantastic. I didn't have a single station that said, no, you can't walk through here. They were all above and beyond helpful. And not just station owners, you know, there was quite a lot of stations I passed through that, you know, it was maybe the owner wasn't there because they owned several stations, or they lived, you know, somewhere else, but they, you know, it was a caretaker just on the property. But everyone welcomed me in, everyone, you know, cooked for me, helped me out, fed my camels. I met a guy called Craig, who was at Nambi Station. He was right before I headed off into the desert,
And I was only going to stop there a night, actually. And it happened to be one of those instances of meeting the right person at the right time. And it was when I was about to head off onto the Amberdale, and I was feeling very nervous about no one else being out there. I was feeling nervous about there being wild camels, and Craig, actually, he was ex-army, and he showed me everything to do with my guns. He sort of properly taught me how to shoot. He re-welded new equipment for me to kind of make all the weights lighter on my camel's backs. He rearranged all my pack gear. And then he spent about several days afterwards actually driving out to where I was camping and delivering my camel's hay and delivering me food, just because he knew how tough it was going to be for me when I entered those remote stretches on my own. So he just really gave me this sort of little boost of support and help before I hit the really remote areas. So fantastic people like that I met that were just, I just, you know, it brings me to tears just how, and just is so humbling how helpful everyone has been. And then out in the desert too, yeah, like I said, you know, Oak Valley was incredibly helpful. You know, the little roadhouse, Ilkulka, out there, they helped me out. And it's amazing sort of the logistics in the outback. That's, you know, nothing is beyond people. People will drive way out of their distances to help you. And there's always a way. There's like where there's a will, there's a way. You know, I had to get food boxes, my food supplies delivered to sort of halfway along the Amberdale track out in the desert. And so the guy who does the fuel run out there from Laverton, which is just on the edge of the desert in WA, he dropped the food boxes out there. They put the food boxes in storage. So yeah, there's just so many times that people have helped me.
Fantastic. And so as the temperature started to creep up early, sort of late 2020, you were coming sort of to almost like the halfway point of your trek across the continent. And at that stage, you decided to take a break and to rest the camels during the hottest part of the year. So that brought you to Kuba Pedy. So tell us about the decision-making around doing that and what happened next.
Well, that really related actually to what I was saying before and how hard it was with feeding the camels. And what a bad season most of Western Australia had. So I didn't anticipate, I guess, how much weight they were going to lose. And because of that, how much slower we were going, because I was trying to feed them more. So we were sort of not covering as many Ks a day. And I remember just, you know, we started to sort of fall behind this schedule that I had created for us. And I remember just thinking, there's no way that we're going to get through the hottest, you know, most arid parts of Australia in the one year. And so, yeah, it was probably about actually 3 months in that I sort of thought, I think we're going to have to make a call and split this trip into 2 years. And, you know, I chatted to a few other camel people out there about it. And at the end of the day, I just felt like I needed to put my camels first and really rest them over the summer and give them time to beef up and put on condition for the second leg of the journey. I remember being absolutely devastated at first because, you know, I think you can get through those tough times by, you know, by knowing the end date or the end goal and knowing, you know, I had put aside in my head, I thought it's going to take me, I think I thought sort of 9 or 10 months, and that was it. That was what I had in my head, what I envisioned. And then all of a sudden went from that to sort of 2 years, and it was like it just became absolutely overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But out of that, actually, it's, you know, it's been the best decision that I've ever made. It's my camels, yeah, it gave my camels time to have a break, and they're looking fat and healthy and happy. And also gave me time to sort of restock and to reflect and look back on it, you know, positively. I think if I, you know, kept pushing myself and the camels, we all would have been coming in pretty miserable. So
yeah, and so what you did is you took the camels into the Flinders Ranges and let them really let them go. And over a number of months, and you went back to Brisbane yourself. Now you're back down in the Flinders Ranges now, and you've mustered your camels. You found them again. And as you just said, they're looking fit, fat and healthy and ready to start again. So where to from here? What will you do next? And tell us a little bit about how different the second half of this adventure is going to be as you come down through New South Wales to your finishing point in Byron Bay.
Yeah, so different, I think. So, basically we arrived in Cooper Pedy, trucked the camels down here to the Flinders, and just the last couple of weeks we've had to go out and find them again because they were released onto Beltana Station, which is about 900 square kilometres, so a huge expanse, which was lovely to see because my camels, you know, had come from the wild and they'd had about, you know, a year training and, you know, 6 months walking and stuff. So it was such an amazing feeling to be able to take halters and ropes and everything off them and just go sort of be free again. They've had the best time. And so now I have just found them, which was a week-long ordeal, actually, and involved a couple of light aircrafts having to go up and track them down because we just literally couldn't find a single track out there. They'd gone walkabout and were hiding in the bush. And now I have to sort of get them a little bit fit and ready to go, and then we will head back up on the truck to our finishing spot, which was Mount Clarence Station in Cooper Pedy, and we set off in about a month's time heading towards Byron, and that route's going to take us through, we're going to go through William Creek along the Oodnadatta track. We're going to sort of head just on the northern side of Maree, hit Cameron Corner. Then we're going to track mainly along the Queensland-New South Wales border to Byron Bay. And I really think it's going to be a totally different second half. One of the biggest things is that we still have a bit of remote country to travel, the first couple of months, obviously around, Oodnadatta track and crossing over the Birdsville track and through the Strzelecki Desert, that's all pretty remote still. But as we get closer to the East Coast, we're going to start to run into civilization, which it's funny now that I have done the desert stretches, I sort of think, oh, that was easy. now I'm more terrified about going into civilization. Not because I'm scared of other humans, but my camels have never experienced anything like that. They came from the deserts. They've been in the deserts most of their life. And they've never been around large towns or cars or, lots of buildings and people. And
will you actually be walking along some major highways at some stage?
Yeah, well, this is what I've realized. And when I went home for the summer, actually, it gave me the opportunity to do a bit of a recce driving around Byron and towards Stanthorpe, because one of my biggest worries was getting through the Great Dividing Range, finding a way to get through that really mountainous area off the highway. So we were looking at basically, one of the main passes through there is the Bruxner Highway, which is obviously not ideal with a train of five camels. So I contacted lots of private property owners, and we found our way through the range. But as we head towards sort of Casino and Lismore, we're definitely going to be, and maybe even before then, we're going to be on the bitumen, definitely.
Right, you're going to be quite the centre of attention, I feel, when those days come.
Unfortunately, I know. Here I'm thinking, hopefully we'll just sneak in the back way to Byron and no one will notice.
I don't think so. Somehow, Sophie, I don't think that is the way it's going to be. Well, look, we wish you all the best for the second half of your incredible journey across Australia. And, we look forward to catching up with you and just staying in touch along the way. And then talking to you when it's all done and dusted and hearing, what different challenges you faced and how you overcame them. But it is a magnificent and epic idea to walk across the country with camels and, probably get to understand what can all the differences. So many of us never really get to go to those places that, you know, I hope that you inspire other Australians to get out, not necessarily walking with camels, but just to get out and explore Australia, especially, you know, these days when we can't go overseas.
Yes.
And we
do have
a beautiful country that we don't really get around very much. And it is lovely to hear how wonderfully you describe those desert areas as just being actually so full of life.
Especially at the moment, you know, there's been a lot of great rain around Australia and the deserts are flourishing and, you know, there's wildflowers out there and greenery and, yeah, and a ton of life. So it's a great time to explore.
Well, it's been great talking to you and thank you for your time. And I know that you're busy up there planning the next stage. So we've really appreciated having the opportunity to talk to you this morning, Sophie.
Thank you, Chrissy. Lovely to chat.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram, @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.